Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
Yes, Buzzkillers, it's the old professor here, busting myths and taking names. Last time we did a full episode, we had a wonderful introduction to the background of not only the Vietnam War, but the whole the Vietnam conflict writ large, everything that was going on, and the perceptions and realities of how that war not only started, but developed and then ended. This show, once again, fortunately, we have the lovely and talented Professor Nash here to join us to tell us about, more specifically, and about the myths and misconceptions. Professor, it's not a myth that you're here, because I can see you right across the table in the Buzzkill Bunker.
I'm actually here for reals.
And it's not a misconception that we have so many myths about this war. I'm looking at the list on our outline here. It goes on and on and on. There are more myths about this than there are about, you know, the Civil War. Well, that's not true, but an awful lot of them.
Right. Although, of course, remember, this is myths broadly defined. So, broadly in other words, some of them you might not call myths. They might be misconceptions.
Right.
Or people have it mostly right, but not entirely right, that kind of thing. So,
we're going
to have lots of different types of things here.
Well, one of the things that's so fascinating to the Buzzkillers is it's only relatively recently that we start to hear fuller stories about the Vietnam War. Again, we've talked about so many of you emailing in and tweeting or whatever it is that you do. But, you know, can we please talk about the war because of the Ken Burns series that recently finished on PBS? And in that series, we probably learned a lot more than, say, people of our generation and older ever learned before in a popular sense. But there are still dozens of these.
I mean, just look, I mean, you could devote your entire career to doing nothing but reading Vietnam books, and you still wouldn't get through all of them.
That's right.
I mean, there are thousands of them. It's such a rich subject. And once again, it's not repetition. There's still new things to learn. There's still new evidence being revealed.
Right.
There's new. There's still, like, for example, we're learning much more about the Vietnamese sides to this.
Sure.
To this conflict.
Some
of those sources become available. So there's always something new to learn, and there's still, like I said, a lot of things that people either get partly wrong or entirely wrong about the war.
Okay, from an American perspective, I suppose the biggest myth, right, is that the war was winnable and that the U.S. government screwed it up.
Right. And, you know, I hesitate to call this a myth because on the one hand, it's sort of unprovable.
Yeah,
We can't know whether we could have won the war because we didn't.
Right.
And when you lose a war, it's very easy for people to say, well, if only we had done X, Y, Z, we would have won. Well, we can't prove that either. That's very convenient, and that can be of great political utility.
Yes, but it has been used a lot.
Yes, but, you know, or to say, well, if we only had changed this one thing about the war effort, everything would have been different. Well, that's unprovable too. Mm-hmm. And you should be very, very skeptical about these sorts of points that people make. My approach to this would be, if you want to say, well, we could have won the war, could you have won the war at an acceptable cost? Because if you look at how tenacious the Viet Cong and the North Vietnamese were for years, if you look at the sacrifices they were willing to make, it seems to me highly plausible to argue that the only way the United States could have won the war was to invade and conquer North Vietnam.
Oh, okay.
In other words, a much, much larger U.S. military effort and U.S. military presence, which would then be required for years afterwards.
You mean in order to get the North Vietnamese out of South Vietnam and to make sure they don't come back, you'd have to essentially conquer them.
Well, and also, and we keep in mind, at the same time, you'd also have to deploy many more forces to the South to, quote-unquote, pacify the South, right?
Because
they control such, their guerrilla movement is so large, has such broad popular support, has taken so many provinces or is powerful in so many provinces. In other words, you'd have to have a much more massive military effort across the board in North and South.
Yeah.
And then you'd have to pacify the entire country, North and South. In other words, it's not just enough to sort of conquer North Vietnam.
Yeah.
Because the minute you left, they would rise up and create another nationalist/communist regime and begin the whole process over again.
Oh, okay. Because, of course, as you said in the previous episode about this, we always forget about the Civil War aspect of this conflict.
That's right. And if Vietnamese, not all, but a lot of Vietnamese are so bound and determined to be independent and or unified, and they're willing to mm-hmm. fight so long and hard. Remember, they fought for 1,000 years against the Chinese.
Yeah, exactly.
Why
yeah.
wouldn't they fight for 1,000 years against the Americans?
Right, right, right.
Unless you really want to become like hardcore and say, well, the way you win the war is you use nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
Or you engage in genocide or mass murder of Vietnamese. Like, they basically pulverize the country and make it unlivable.
Yeah.
This is all idle speculation, because the United States never would have done that.
Right.
In other words,
right.
for the United States to win on
the
those terms,
we hope. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. For the United States to win on those terms requires the United States not to be the United States.
Ah, gotcha. Gotcha.
And I cannot conceive of a situation. I mean, look at the opposition that cropped up to the war when it was a limited war.
In the early
right.
60s.
In 65 or in 66.
Oh, so, okay.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
When we Americanized the war, but we're not invading North Vietnam, for example.
Gotcha, yeah.
And, you know, we send 500,000 troops, but we don't send 10 million troops. You know, could we have sent 10 million troops? Sure.
Yeah.
Would the American people would they have put up with that sort of sacrifice?
No, not ton.
I mean, that sort of a draft, I mean, they were talking about, I mean, a much bigger draft and a much bigger percentage of the young male population being inducted and sent to Vietnam.
World War II numbers, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Right. That was like a total war, total mobilization. You'd have to look at an army and Air Force and Navy, et cetera, that are millions stronger than they were. Much, much higher sacrifice. And so I guess my bottom line is, could we have won the war? Yes. But what would that have entailed? Would that have entailed a level of sacrifice and commitment that is realistic to assume? And I don't think it is.
Okay, well, along with that myth, there's the idea that, you know, well, along with the idea that we could have won the war, is that we didn't win the war because we had one hand tied behind our
right, back. Which is a famous claim, or that we were somehow, and this goes hand in hand with the sort of romantic notion that we could never actually be defeated by an enemy, but we could only defeat ourselves.
Sure, the hippies, if it hadn't been for the hippies.
Right, hadn't been for the hippies or some other group, or if we'd had leaders who weren't, you know, sort of weak or wimpy or apologetic, if they had gone all out and sort of fully used American power, we could have won. I don't know of any responsible historians who would argue that. It's very difficult to argue, once again, as a matter of fact, because it's sort of counterfactual.
Sure, yeah. Right? That's always a problem.
It's very difficult for one side or another to prove its
claim.
Not
a problem, apparently, for Bill O'Reilly, who writes all kinds of stuff this way, but it is for legitimate and responsible
right,
historians.
Exactly. Yeah. So, but I mean, if you look at historians of Vietnam who look at the way our government fought the war and sort of led the war effort,
yeah,
I don't think any of them would claim we fought with one hand tied behind our back. Now, it is true, for example, there were some geographic limits that LBJ put on the bombing.
Yeah, right.
He was terrified of bringing the Chinese into the war, so he didn't want bombing to take place close to the Chinese border.
Right.
He didn't want to bomb heavily in Haiphong Harbor because he was afraid that Soviet personnel on Soviet ships that were supplying North Vietnam would be killed.
Yeah. In a way, that's a strategic, not to make the war worse, right?
Yes. It's not because he was some sort of, you know, the reasons you're doing this.
He's not a peacenik. He just
right?
doesn't want the Chinese. Yeah,
exactly.
Right.
And so, well, I mean, once again, we should go all out. Well, if all out risks a broader war, then what are you going to do? Go into World War III to win in Vietnam?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Maybe LBJ sort of exaggerated those dangers. I don't know. There was a reluctance to violate Laotian Cambodian neutrality, which was being violated by the North Vietnamese.
Right.
And this is the kind of thing that people latch on. It's like, well, they're doing something like that. Why can't we?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
My question is, would removing these restrictions have made a difference?
Oh, okay.
I wonder. Yeah. That's possible, but that's not definite.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
And once again, it's like you change this one thing. Oh, if only we had bombed up to the Chinese border, that would have changed everything. Well, you need to demonstrate how that would have changed everything.
Yeah.
Would that have increased their problems that they encounter in waging the war? Yes. Would it have killed more Vietnamese? Yes. Would have won the war? I'm not sure.
Yeah.
We don't know. It's very, very difficult to claim that. From another angle, I would say, how limited was the war truly? Leave aside those things I just said.
Oh, all right.
We sent in 500,000 troops. That's not a token force.
No,
that's a
no.
really, really large force.
And you tend to forget that because they seem to come back in dribs and drabs, and it seems to be very, you know, small platoons going out fighting, trying to find the North Vietnamese in guerrilla warfare. Mm-hmm. We don't realize, if we didn't knew it all, or we we forget that it was half a million.
Yeah. Now, keep in mind, a lot of those, in fact, most of them are not actually in infantry companies.
And out
in the bush. Nevertheless, it is a massive deployment by any standard. I'm pretty sure, I forget the exact number, our entire military today is about a million people.
Yeah, so.
Now, our total military was much, much bigger during the Cold War. But still, let's put this in perspective. This is at a time when defending Western Europe, in other words, the quote-unquote really important allies, we had about 300,000 men.
Uh-huh.
So we are making a bigger commitment.
Yeah.
As of 1968, 69, we're making a bigger commitment to South Vietnam than we have to all of Western Europe. That's how out of whack this deployment is.
Okay.
So I guess my question is that really a limited commitment? Or look at the magnitude of the bombing.
Yeah.
Our bombers were much more powerful, had much bigger payloads. Our bombs were typically much bigger.
Yeah.
We bombed much more heavily. If you go online, there's a lot of debate over this.
Mm-hmm.
Difficult to precisely measure. But if you look at the widely agreed upon numbers when it comes to tonnage of U.S. bombs dropped,
right,
we dropped around or at least three times the tons of bombs in Vietnam that we dropped in all of World War II.
Oh, right. Which was bombing was more or less unhindered by political problems back home.
Right. Also we were fighting all out against the Germans and the Japanese total war.
Right, right.
So
this is three times that.
This is three times that. So, and this is, by the way, dropped in on the North and in the South. It's both. Okay. Right. But still, it's a lot of tonnage. It's a lot of ordnance. It's a huge number. And, you know, could you drop more than that? Of course.
Would it work?
Could we have dropped six World War IIs on them? Yeah. Or 10? Yeah, we could have. So, yes, this is limited and you not doing everything you can do. But you dropped this massive amount of ordnance and did not achieve your goals.
Yeah.
What makes you think multiplying that several times is somehow going to magically make a difference, right? You're already inflicting massive casualties on the enemy and still they're fighting.
Yeah. I think people must not, not enough people know the three times right. figure. They just don't know.
It's a big number. So was our effort limited? Yes. Were we holding back and not doing certain things? Yes, certainly at first. But by the way, look at also the Nixon years. One of Nixon's whole approaches to this is, oh, thank God I'm president because now I can do all these sorts of things LBJ wasn't going to do.
Right.
Now, he's presiding over time when we're drawing down our ground troops. But he takes the gloves off when it comes to incursions into Cambodia.
Sure.
Bombing the Ho Chi Minh Trail, bombing Haiphong Harbor and mining it, bombing close to the Chinese border. He does all those things, and it really doesn't change the outcome.
Yeah.
So this, once again, this doesn't prove anything, quote unquote, prove anything, but you should be very, very skeptical. And some of these claims are incredibly facile. It's like, well, if we only had done this, we would have won, but because of these Weasley politicians and these traitors that we lost.
Well, that brings up the sort of next point, you know, that the war was lost by traitors, by liberals, by hippies, the media, all that sort of stuff in the background, all happening in the U.S. is ruining it all.
Yeah, that's, you know, first of all, the sorts of limits on the fighting I just talked about, like LBJ not bombing, those are not brought about by the public, not brought about by liberals or hippies or anti-war protesters. Those are decisions made in Washington, D.C. And they're decisions often made at a time when they can make those decisions free of any such considerations.
Oh, right. The early part of the war.
You know, the things like search and destroy missions and the body count, those are military decisions made in the Pentagon. Those are not them succumbing to pressure.
Right.
So right there, we've got a problem with the argument that these are somehow insiders who are losing it for us. Or look at the media. I mean, by the way, there are all sorts of books about the coverage
of the war.
Yeah. Was all the coverage great? No. Was some of it misleading? Yeah, probably. It's going to be.
Yeah.
But the basic truth is they're reporting a war that's not going very well. And the American people are learning that this war is not going very well. That's called democracy, right?
Yeah, that's right.
If American people watch the news and find out this war is not going very well and start to ask questions about it and don't get good, very good answers in their view, and they turn against the war, that's how it's supposed to work. Now, by the way, I've talked to people who essentially take the viewpoint when it comes to war, essentially of Leninist, what's called democratic centralism.
Yeah.
In other words, it's a democracy until we go to war, and then you all need to just shut up and let the government do its job.
Yeah, yeah.
Indefinitely.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, if that's your model of how this democracy should conduct wars, fine. More power to you.
Yeah, unsubscribe from Professor Buskill if that's your model.
Yeah, I would highly recommend that. But if, on the other hand, you think this is a democracy all the time that happens to go to war sometimes, then the American people should have a voice. And sure. if a majority of the American people decide that this war was a mistake and we need to cut it short, well, then that's what the politicians need to do. That's not about traitors. That's not about people being misled. Yeah. That's about people regretting that maybe they weren't paying attention enough before, or maybe we need to correct our mistakes, right? If a democracy can't correct its mistakes, dictatorship's not going to correct its mistakes.
No.
Right?
No,
to me, that's
no.
the whole point of a democracy, is right. that you can learn from your errors and you can not throw good blood and good money after bad.
Well, and also the whole question is, you know, we only lost because the United States only lost because it had a hand tied behind its back and because it was betrayed from within. We never talk about why did we lose, but right. why did they win?
Right, exactly. For example, I teach a Vietnam War class that focuses on the Vietnamese side.
Yeah.
And the book I use, that's one of the sort of organizing principles of the book, which is not why did the United States lose, but why did the communists win?
Right.
And it always reminds me of this famous anecdote, which may not actually, it's apocryphal. I don't know if it actually happened.
Oh, okay.
But allegedly after the Civil War, when, you know, Gettysburg and Pickett's Charge were such a big topic for discussion,
right.
because it was a turning point in the war.
Which we've talked about in the previous episode.
We talked about that a little bit. General George Pickett, the Confederate commander of Pickett's Charge, at a certain point got tired of all this Monday morning quarterbacking and all these yeah. discussions like, well, if only this Confederate regiment had done this differently or blah, blah, blah. And at one point, he lost his patience and was asked something like, so like, well, why do you think we, why, so why did we lose at Gettysburg? And his response was, I believe the Yankees had something to do with it.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Now, even if that's not a real quote, it's a great quote because it raises an important point, which is, I believe the Viet Cong had something to do with it.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, the communists were doing lots of things right. They were doing lots of things wrong.
Yeah,
we're doing lots of
militarily,
things right,
yeah, right?
I mean, they were fighting very effectively. They made sure that they did what was necessary to gain a lot of popular support, which is a requirement for a successful guerrilla war. They were incredibly tenacious.
Right.
They were willing to put up with enormous sacrifices. I mean, they were doing lots of things right, which were reasons why they won, rather than us sort of all this navel gazing. Why did we lose? What did we do wrong?
Right.
It's entirely okay. possible. I can't prove this, but it's entirely possible that there's nothing we could have done. By the way, a lot of generals and politicians who were involved at the time,
yeah.
either at the time or later, came to believe that there's nothing we could have done.
Right, right,
now,
right.
Now, yeah. in some cases, they're going to be sort of defending themselves by making that claim.
Sure, sure.
But a lot of them are pretty sober people who have thought about this a lot at the time and tried lots of things, none of which worked.
Well, you know, we've often talked, and you've given us very clear indication of what a lot of the moral reasons, moral importance behind, say, World War II because of Japanese militarism and Nazism, all those things. You know, we definitely not only should have won those wars, that war, but we, you know, we had to win the war. How does that work in this case?
My view is that sometimes I think we ask the wrong question, because just like the question is, what did we do wrong? The question we pose for ourselves is, could we have won?
Yeah.
And I would argue that's a fine question. There are other questions like, should we have won?
Yeah, right.
In other words, was this a cause worth fighting for?
Oh, right. Yeah, that's right. Getting back to the
you
the
know,
roots of it. Yeah.
The roots of it. Like, for example, was preserving an independent South Vietnam necessary? Was it worth it? Right?
Yeah.
We at the time, we said it was part of the free world. Was it? Not really. One of the reasons we lose is that it was a corrupt dictatorship.
Yeah, that's right.
That it couldn't successfully, it had some, but it couldn't successfully put together a mass base of support. And so it's very hard to fight and win a guerrilla war or any kind of war under those circumstances. So should we have won? In other words, even if we had won and preserved that country, was it worth preserving? And I'll remind people that in 1975, when South Vietnam collapsed, and that country was reunified under communist rule, mm-hmm. I think it's very difficult to argue that we were significantly less secure as a country on the world scene.
No, oh, yeah, absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Lots of people were
it's
saying,
almost as if it
right,
didn't happen.
Dominoes did not fall.
Right.
We
right.
were not any less secure. Our standing in the world against the Soviet Union was no less secure. You could argue the opposite. You could argue that we were stronger because we had ceased wasting money in South Vietnam and we could spend it on other things, like on other economic and military causes. So should we have won is a good question. Should we have been there is also a good question, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And here I always loved to run this thought experiment, which is, let's say we had somehow managed to win the war. And by win the war, I mean we preserve an independent South Vietnam and we don't have to be there anymore.
Right.
At least
okay.
in the medium term.
Okay.
Okay, let's run the thought experiment. Let's say in 1965, you ask the American people, we're going to go to war in Vietnam.
Yeah.
We're going to succeed in preserving independent South Vietnam, but it's going to cost 58,000 U.S. dead, 150,000 U.S. wounded. It's going to cost about $1 trillion in today's 2017 dollars, et cetera. Should we do it?
Not when it. Well, most people would say no when they hadn't even heard of Vietnam.
Right. So, and that
58,000 dead.
Yeah. That to me, that puts in a really different perspective, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because all the people say, oh, we could have won. Well, would it have been worth it even if we did?
Yeah.
Right? If national security policy, as most people would agree, is supposed to be sort of undergo cost-benefit analysis,
yeah.
like the amount of effort and pain and sacrifice devoted to this should be commensurate with that thing's value in the bigger picture.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone would take that deal. I don't think anybody would. They would say, well, first of all, they'd say, we're South Vietnam.
Yeah, right.
I mean, sounds glib, but I think it's true. Yeah. We're South Vietnam. Why would we devote that much effort to that place?
Yeah.
And the people on the other end would not have any good answers for that.
No.
So,
and it's not that we're being buzzkill peaceniks here. And, you know, I get a lot of grief on Twitter and other social media about the supposed biases in this show. It's, you know, we have argued before on other shows that, you know, the cost of fighting World War II was absolutely necessary because of Japanese militarism and German and Nazism. And there's practically no moral question in that. But this is entirely different.
Right. In other words, I'm not saying we shouldn't engage the question, could we have won?
Oh, yes. No, I know what you mean.
But I'm saying you should probably tackle some other questions first.
Right.
Right? Because the question, could we have won, presupposes that we belonged there and should have been fighting there.
Yeah, right.
But if you engage in that other debate first, then maybe you don't even get to that second question.
Yeah.
Or that first question, I should say. Right? So it's also important, I think, to look at the reasons, and I ticked them off very briefly in episode one, but review the reasons for Americanizing the war, and you see there are problems with most, if not all, of these, right? Yeah. Like containment.
Right.
Yeah, containment said to the containment theory as believed in by American policymakers was you have to contain them everywhere.
Right.
Well, actually, you don't.
No.
And in a way, big picture, I mean super big picture, if the Soviet Empire, as most people would argue, in the end collapses because of imperial overstretch, in other words, it has too many commitments.
Sure, yeah.
Then in a way, you know, it's kind of an odd argument to make, but in a way, them having a couple of additional countries might actually cost them.
Yeah,
right.
Hasten
their decline, right? There's that aspect to it. We suffered losses in the Cold War. Countries like Cuba went communist.
Yeah.
Afghanistan was invaded by the Soviet Union. Some countries in Africa or the Middle East were at one point or another allied with the Soviet Union.
Yeah.
It didn't matter in the end.
No.
It didn't matter at the time, really. A lot of people would freak out about losing country X. Dominoes didn't fall.
Yeah, I think that's a very important part.
Unless you're going to argue that when the Vietnamese invaded Cambodia in 1979 and occupied it for, I think, 8 or 9 years.
Yeah.
Unless you're going to argue that's dominoes falling, typically that's not how communism spread. Communism, to the extent of the spread, which wasn't very much,
yeah.
usually
Another
was...
Another thing we forget.
Usually was an unattached communist revolution that's indigenous.
Hence Cuba.
Cuba coming to power and then in the context of the Cold War being forced to ally with the Soviet Union, which becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. There's
right,
that.
Sure.
Or communism was spread at the point of a bayonet with the Red Army in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, right.
Or in this case, Vietnam invading Cambodia in 1979, which, by the way, saved the Cambodian people from the Khmer Rouge.
Yes, that's right.
The Vietnamese did not invade for that reason, but that ended up being a humanitarian intervention, which saved the Cambodian people from the uniquely murderous regime of Pol Pot,
sure, yeah.
which killed 2 million of its own people, by the way. So in any case, the domino theory is problematic. Applying containment is very problematic. Credibility is super problematic.
I mean, the U.S. shouldn't look like cowards,
right? Exactly. In other words, we have to impress our important allies by coming to the aid of an unimportant ally. That sort of thought process really problematic, especially as I said in the other episode, when the main allies you're trying to impress are the ones who are telling you
don't
in no uncertain terms, don't do this.
Yeah.
Get out of this. Cut the cord. You can't win. Move on. Like, just declare victory and withdraw, as one senator famously once said.
Right.
Domestic politics, that's in some ways legit, because if in, say, 1964, 1965, LBJ decides, you know what, this war is not worth it, we're not going to Americanize it, and then the communists win, he might have taken a hit for that. It's another what if. We don't know for sure.
Yeah.
There were other countries like Laos, for example, mm-hmm. which was faced with a communist uprising where it was basically taken out of the Cold War. There was an international agreement that basically was a negotiated settlement and power sharing. It was sort of taken off the table. Didn't take any domestic heat for that.
No, absolutely.
So, you know, if in 1964 you sit down with the North Vietnamese and say, look, we can kill millions of you.
Yeah.
Or we can cut a deal. Mm. And even maybe a face-saving deal.
Yeah,
like,
sure,
we have nationwide elections 5 years down the road. We have a provisional government. We have a sort of a caretaker government or something. In other words, what ended up happening, a decent interval without all the pain and suffering in the meantime, they might have gone for that.
Yeah, yeah.
You know,
and the American public would have forgotten and not noticed 5 years down the road.
We could have come up with some sort of face-saving device to avoid Americanizing the war and not going down this road. That's possible. And American arrogance, I mean, sometimes that is exaggerated as a factor. Like I said, a lot of Americans who get involved, including the military, by the way.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of generals in the Pentagon who are arguing that we need to get involved in this war because we'll get a quick victory.
Right.
A lot of them have misgivings, too. In fact, they've been criticized for not being forthright with the civilian leadership about the possibilities.
Oh, right.
There's a lot of people misleading each other. People misleading themselves.
All right. Well, we'll look more into these questions of people's intentions and things like that when we get right back from this sponsorship break. Okay, we're back here with Professor Nash talking about the myths and misconceptions of the Vietnam War. Professor, so many of these things run so deep. It's almost as if they've become their own facts in American culture and American memory. You hear a lot of this: U.S. policymakers, U.S. presidents, U.S. politicians were well-intentioned.
Yes. It's not only in this case, in most cases.
Okay.
And I'm sure you see this in other countries, too. You certainly see in America.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, we like to feel good about ourselves. We like to be proud of ourselves and our country. We like to believe that even if and when we do something wrong, that we did it for the right reasons.
Uh-huh.
Or that we were well-intentioned. And this you see at the beginning of the Ken Burns series.
Mm-hmm.
And this is something that some people have already criticized. This is not original with me. In other words, some other people have also made this point, but I think it's a good one, which is if you look at the actual history of the Vietnam War, it's really difficult to say that the American leaders, military and civilian, were sort of quote-unquote well-intentioned.
Oh, okay.
They were at certain points and in certain ways, but there are other ways not so much. And this, at the very least, this should not be accepted as an article of faith, which is what it is.
It is major an article of faith among a lot of people.
They're coming from both military leaders and civilian leaders. They're certainly civilians, more so the civilians. There are lies and deceit about the risks involved in getting involved.
Uh-huh.
Lies and deceit about the nature of the South Vietnamese government.
Right.
In other words, that this is a democracy and they deserve our support.
Especially about that, yeah.
Lies about the stakes. In other words, well, here, and, you know, the domino theory is not necessarily a lie, but there are people who should have questioned it, and they adopted it without question and believed that, well, if, you know, this is the keystone and the arch, and if South Vietnam falls, then inexorably all these other countries fall. They should have known better, I'll put it that way, because history up to that point had not operated in that way.
No.
There were all sorts of lies about the nature of the conflict. Like, for example, they portrayed it as an international aggression, as a sort of a cross-border invasion, when, as I said in episode one, it's much more complicated than that. Yes, it's also a civil war.
And the civil war part is very, very important.
Right. And then, for example, all our enemies are communists. And in fact, a lot of our enemies are not communists. They're actually just working with the communists.
Oh, right.
There was a lot of lies and deceit about the impossibility of winning. And there's actually one in the Ken Burns series, there's one interviewee who actually points this out. It's clear now from all the documents and from the literature that Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, a major architect of Americanization of the war, by the way.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
He had concluded as early as 1965 that this war was not winnable.
65? That's 65. Before,
yeah. So this is, I think it's later in 65. So the war has been Americanized. We're beefing up our military commitment and the number of troops we have in the military in Vietnam. But he has already concluded the war is not winnable. And yet he continued to prosecute the war and act publicly as if it were winnable for the next 2 years.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Now, for what it's worth, he was, by the end, a tormented soul who essentially had a nervous breakdown at the end of his term. He had Johnson actually made wisecracks about maybe he was going to commit suicide. He was basically pushed aside early 68 and sent to the World Bank.
And later in life writes about how bad this was.
Yes, but he's not alone. Mm-hmm. There were lots of people who had serious misgivings about the war and continued to act and speak publicly as if they didn't.
Oh.
That's not being well-intentioned.
No, that's deluding
yourself. That's like essentially saying to the American people, there are things more important than the truth.
Yeah, right.
And in order to do what I think is right, I have to lie to you.
Uh-huh.
In a democracy, we can't have that sort of leadership acting on these sorts of important issues in that way. I know it has happened in other cases. I know a lot of people are very cynical about political leadership and, all politicians lie all the time.
Yeah.
Well, they don't.
Yeah.
They don't all lie all the time, and they don't lie all the time about really important issues like this. You know, and by the way, you've seen it before. There's a certain elitism among American leaders.
Yeah,
I know. A belief that if we're straight with the American people, they won't understand. So we have to lie to them.
Yeah, yeah.
You see this in the lead up to World War II. You see this in the alliance with the Russians during World War II, right? We have to portray them as Americans. Otherwise, Americans won't get the idea that we're making a pact with the devil, basically.
Yeah.
Throughout American history, our leaders don't give the American people enough credit, is my personal belief. And you certainly see it in Vietnam.
But going along with that is the idea that because of the good intentions, because of the U.S. was well intentioned, that when the United States gets in, Vietnam is such a quagmire that it can't get out.
Right, and this is not necessarily a quote unquote myth.
Yeah,
I think it's an issue of unfortunate framing.
Oh, okay.
And how you frame the question and frame the debate, because it's almost instinctive now. It's almost automatic the way we talk about the Vietnam quagmire.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and the concept of like it's sort of like quicksand or it's a swamp and you step in it and then you can't extricate yourself.
Yeah.
Now, on the one hand, obviously it's true in that wars, and this is a truism, we've certainly seen this in our own age, wars are easy to start and they're hard to end.
Yeah, right.
Especially when you're a superpower, especially when you feel like you have to worry about prestige and credibility, it's very difficult to quote unquote cut and run.
Yeah.
Even if you realize you've made a big mistake. My problem with the framing or sort of the metaphor of the quagmire is that at sort of a basic, sort of maybe even subconscious level, it depicts Vietnam as sort of this inherently nasty, rotten place that, once again, innocent, well-intentioned America ended up in.
Oh, okay.
Right? Like it was a misstep. Like we tripped and ended up in Vietnam. Or we were just innocently walking along and we put our foot in a quagmire. And now we're in a quagmire and now we can't get out.
Well, we showed in the previous show that it was at every step.
Yes.
So the thing, step, we decide for more involvement, more involvement. More
and
involvement.
In a way, it's maybe not intentional, but it's a way of very subtle blame shifting.
Uh huh. Uh huh.
In other words, that Vietnam is something that happened to us. It's not something we did.
Oh,
Now, I realize some people may say that's nitpicking. But I think it's actually important. How you frame the issue and frame the question is very important, especially if you are trying to shirk responsibility.
Yeah.
We went into Vietnam knowingly. We went into Vietnam because of decisions that we made.
Right, right.
It didn't happen to us.
Yeah, that's right.
Right?
There's
a great book by Fred Logoval about the 1964 period called Choosing War.
Yeah, yeah.
It makes a really, really strong argument that Lyndon Johnson chose to go to war.
Hmm.
That, you know, it's not like, well, we ended up in Vietnam and it was inexorable in this sort of march to war. No, it was not inexorable.
Right,
you were making decisions all along the way. And to call it a quagmire, yeah, because it's hard to get out, yeah, absolutely.
Sure.
That part of it, no question. But the idea that it's something that sucks us in or that we stumble into through no fault of our own because we were well-intentioned, I have a big issue with that. Well, you can make a strong argument that we did not have to Americanize the war in Vietnam.
And when we were setting up the show, we were talking about it, and when you were, you know, sketching out what to talk about specifically in this part of the show, gender came up. And this is fascinating because it's certainly something I hadn't thought of before in terms of the war and extending the war. But this cult of male toughness in the Cold War that you think that you argue is so crucial.
In terms of history, I think it's kind of fascinating too, because I think it's a case where the broader debate over Vietnam hasn't caught up with the scholarship. Because scholarship pays a lot of attention to questions of gender when it comes to the Vietnam War.
Okay.
And I would argue big picture that gender is much more important to the decisions that were made and the way the war was fought and the reasons why people fought or, for example, volunteered to serve in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Plays a much bigger role than a lot of people realize.
Mm-hmm.
And for example, and this is true at the top and the bottom, unlike in some cases in history, I would argue it's true top and bottom.
Huh.
There's a book called Imperial Brotherhood, which I highly recommend, by Robert Dean, which is about John F. Kennedy and his advisors
and how
that White House was pervaded with what Dean calls an ideology of masculinity.
Right. Okay.
These are not just anybody. These are World War II veterans.
Right.
Often who had sort of elite combat service along with an elite education. And after World War II, they styled themselves as these sort of tough but intelligent sort of warrior intellectuals.
Oh, right.
Sometimes they're referred to the best and the brightest, right? There are other sort of references. Right, otherwise, But these are people for whom there is machismo and male toughness. It's almost a cult.
Right.
And they worry even more so than most post-World War II American men about things like toughness, masculinity, macho.
Vigor,
not being a wimp, being physically fit. Right, having gone soft in this modern organization man age where you sit behind a desk and you are dominated by your wife and who spends all your money. And so he argues, and he doesn't argue that this is why we went into Vietnam, but he argues that this was an important influence.
Yeah.
In sort of background influence into getting us into Vietnam.
And we tend to forget that there are a lot of these background cultural things.
In other words, decisions are not made in a vacuum.
Until the research comes up and shows all this. It's very important.
And so then even more so, if you look at someone like Lyndon Johnson, who, if you look at his biography and you look at some of the books written about him, he's the poster child for the insecure male.
Yes, absolutely.
And he actually revealed to a journalist fairly early on, I think it was Doris Kearns Goodwin, where he said he had this recurring nightmare. And in the nightmare, he was sort of strapped to the ground face up, sort of like Gulliver.
Yeah.
Like tied, like literally tied and staked to the ground.
Yeah.
And he's surrounded by this big hostile crowd that is leaning over him and screaming at him, "Coward, coward, coward."
Wow.
Yeah. It's really bizarre. It's bizarre. Yeah. Not only bizarre that he would have the dream, bizarre that he would admit it.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing. And if you look at other things in his biography, this is clearly a man who is constantly measuring himself against other men, very insecure about his relative lack of education. That's why he calls his advisors his Harvards. Because he went to, Southwest Texas Teachers College.
That's right.
He's not highly educated. He was very bright, but he was not highly educated.
Right.
And so it's pretty clear, and you saw this in the war against Spain in 1898, by the way, some good history about this, that a reason and sort of part of the background is this setting in which a president is terrified that if he doesn't go to war in Vietnam, he's going to be declared a wimp.
Yeah,
he's
going to
be declared weak against communists, that you can't rely on him. He's not a tough guy. He's afraid to make sacrifices, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And you're referring to the war against Spain because it's Teddy Roosevelt.
The Teddy Roosevelt generation, and where there's a very good book on this I could recommend that makes it quite clear that this is a generation of young men trying to prove themselves, and that if you oppose war against Spain or if you oppose annexation of the Philippines, you are a wimp, you're a panty waist, you're mollycoddled, you're a Nancy, all the sort of terms they used at the time to sort of shame effeminate men. Or men they consider to be effeminate. It's a book by Kristen Hoganson. It's called Fighting for American Manhood. It came out in, 1998.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great book, a great complement to other books about the war against Spain in 1898, and really sort of explores some of these gender issues. But it's also that scene at the bottom, and I was impressed by how often you see this in the Ken Burns series.
Yeah.
But we've seen it elsewhere too, and that is a lot of young American men volunteer to go fight in Vietnam for gendered reasons.
Oh, okay.
Partly remember
volunteer
this.
Volunteer to fight.
Yeah. Volunteer to fight. Forget the figures, but I'm pretty sure that most of the men who served in Vietnam were volunteers.
Oh, right.
Don't quote me on that. It was certainly a much larger number than a lot of people think. I'll put it that way.
Right, okay.
Right, because the draftees get all the attention. A lot of people volunteered.
Mm-hmm.
And another book, recommending books, I would recommend Ron Kovic's book, Born on the 4th of July.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah.
Very short book, made into a movie. And I'm here to tell you, he's not alone. There are a lot of young people who grew up in the shadow of the World War II veterans, in many cases the sons of World War II veterans.
Yeah, yeah.
Grew up on John Wayne movies.
Yeah.
And they looked forward. You see it in several guys in the Vietnam series, the Ken Burns series, talk about how they were sort of itching to go to Vietnam to prove themselves.
Yeah.
They really wanted to get into combat. Part of it is they bought into the hype that military service, quote unquote, makes you into a man.
Yeah.
Which you still see now today, unfortunately, sometimes, right? That's the only way you can be a true man is to be in the military. I would dispute that, of course, having not been in the military.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But a lot of these people, they think that, you know, how do I can sort of replicate the experience of the World War II veterans and become a man by going to Vietnam.
Yeah,
now, obviously, for most of them, it doesn't work out that way. But there is a certain gendered thinking that is involved in the decisions that young men make all across the United States.
Right, and there's tons of evidence, as you pointed out, the whole point about becoming a man and going in and earning your stripes.
That's a real powerful theme in this period. Especially because you know, when you're raised by the World War II generation, you look up to them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You play toy soldier, you play board games, you read about World War II, and you fantasize, you know, you play not just Cowboys and Indians, but you play World War II with your friends. And then now there's an opportunity for you to do the real thing. You got to step up and do it. That's sort of your duty. Otherwise, you're shirking your duty, not just as an American, but as a man.
And we should also talk about, before we go for station identification, is that there are myths on both sides of the political spectrum in this country. There are left-wing myths or right-wing myths.
Yes.
What are some of the left-wing myths?
There are so many that no one remains untouched by them. You know, a lot of the historical studies of Vietnam have been done by quote-unquote liberal academic professors.
Yeah.
And, you know, lest people think that, well, that this is me being another liberal panty waist professor only objects to sort of conservative myths. There are certainly left-wing myths out there. A lot of them you saw at the time.
Yeah, right.
But
right.
Some you have also seen since. And for example, I occasionally go on comment boards and you see similar things.
Yeah.
Some of these myths being kept alive in the public. One left-wing myth is that this was a capitalist war.
Right, okay.
That this was a war that maybe even our civilian and military leadership didn't want to go into, but they had to because they're basically lackeys for American corporate capital and multinational corporations.
Okay.
Because war is always good for business, and so that's why we went to war in Vietnam. This was a real popular myth among the anti-war movement.
Right, right.
Especially like, you know, Students for a Democratic Society and the New Left and those sorts of people. They love this argument.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, there's no evidence for it.
No, and there's also generally no evidence for the idea that war in general is good for the economy. In fact, it almost never is.
That's true. For example, and pretty much no matter how you slice it, first of all, there's no evidence of business leaders contacting our military and civilian leaders saying, hey, we need to go to war.
Yeah, and we need you to buy more of our guns or whatever.
We don't go to war because of, for example, lobbying or pressure groups that are maybe secretly funded by corporate capital.
Yeah.
There's no evidence of that. If you look at American economic interests around the world in 1965, painfully little U.S. business interests in Southeast Asia in general South Vietnam in particular.
Right.
You know, for example, if there were huge oil deposits in South Vietnam, you might be able to say, oh, that's why we're doing it. It's a war for oil.
Right.
No. No. We had so I don't know the actual numbers. I don't have them with me. But we had such small, for example, our foreign investment in South Vietnam was minuscule.
Sure.
Partly because it was wrecked by civil war.
Yeah, right.
What shareholder is going to support you? Yeah, let's pump lots of investment money into South Vietnam. So there's no evidence for that. Now, it is true that some companies made a lot of money once the war starts. I mean, that is true. There is always money to be made off of war.
By the
American arms manufacturers, right, sure. Like the military industrial complex, as Eisenhower called it. You know, Dow Chemical.
Yeah.
You know, the arms manufacturers, the aerospace firms.
Yeah, sure.
Huge amount of money to be made in Vietnam by them, no question. But that's once the war starts.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean they successfully push for war in order for them to make money.
Right.
That's once again, don't confuse. What was it? Post hoc, ergo propter hoc. Just because it happened afterwards doesn't mean it was caused by the thing that came before.
That's right. That's right.
A second left-wing myth would be that this was a militarist war.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that this is, and this is unfortunately still a stereotype you see on the left a lot,
yeah.
Which is we go to war because military people want war.
Right. They're trained for it. The organization is built for it.
In other words, so if you're a professional soldier, you're a warmonger. That, yeah. I would say, is a really unfortunate slur against our military.
Yeah.
Which is really no one should be saying that, and yet some people still do. By the way, this has actually been studied by political scientists.
Yeah, yeah.
They've actually measured the views toward war of civilians and civilian leaders versus military leaders, and it's often the civilians, the so-called armchair generals, who push more strongly for war than the generals do.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
That's a re, and that I would say that's actually a myth. I mean, that capital M myth that is really unfortunate.
But it's seen over and over.
You see it over and over again. One of the most unfortunate ones that I remember is from the 1991 movie JFK by Oliver Stone.
Right. Yeah.
As I probably mentioned before, I'm not a huge Stone fan. In that movie, he actually, and of course, he's very slippery. When he was asked at the time, he posited that the movie was a counter myth.
Yeah.
Which is a way of just exonerating yourself from the ridiculous claims you've made in your movie. There's actually a scene in the movie where LBJ is arguing with his generals and says, blah, 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 blah. Then you all get your damn war.
Yeah.
You know, because the generals are these sort of evil militarists who are pushing for war. On the contrary, as I may have mentioned earlier, actually it's very topical because our current national security advisor is this guy, H.R. McMaster.
Right.
Who is not only a career military officer and general. He also has a history PhD.
Yeah, that's right. That's
and he
right,
published
yeah.
his book. It's called Dereliction of Duty. And the whole thrust of that book, and the book is controversial. Some people disagree with it. But the thrust of the book is that during the peak years of the Vietnam War, top generals had deep misgivings about the war and refused to share them with the civilian leadership.
Oh.
To their discredit.
Yeah, that's
in
right.
In other words,
right.
his basic thesis is these are people who failed because they did not give the civilian leadership their best advice.
Oh, because they thought
hopped on the bandwagon like everybody else. They were essentially politicians. They didn't want to upset the president. They wanted to keep their job. They wanted to get a promotion. So they go along even though they think this war is a mistake.
Yeah.
That's a very different model, a very different reality from the idea that they're itching to go into this war and any war and they're sort of chomping at the bit. No reason to believe that, not when it comes to the top leaders in the Pentagon.
There's also a big myth about race and the numbers of soldiers drafted from different races.
Right. And this is one that's, once again, very popular on the left. You see it quite a bit. You see it repeated by a lot of people. It's become a thing. It's become sort of a trope, maybe.
Yeah.
And it has a ring of authenticity because it fits in neatly with the truth, which is the fact that we live in a racist society that has oppressed African Americans,
right,
and that African Americans have not enjoyed equality in this country, and they certainly didn't in the 1960s.
No.
And so,
remember, buzzkillers, we're still talking about civil rights acts and still have to be passed in the 1960s.
That's right. And so it's relatively early in that history. But the claim is that black people, because they were oppressed and mistreated, that they suffered disproportionate casualties in Vietnam.
Mm.
I've even seen people claim that basically recruiters went and sort of quote unquote cleaned out the ghettos.
Yeah.
In other words, they focused their efforts where they could get bodies into the military with little political cost.
Uh-huh.
Because of course the black community was essentially powerless and not in a position to push back against this sort of disproportionate doling out of the burden.
What's the actual truth?
The actual truth is there were at first, African Americans were disproportionately inducted into the military.
Right, inducted doesn't mean going to combat, though.
Correct, that's true. So they were inducted in larger numbers. They were overrepresented in Vietnam and overrepresented in combat units. Although you should keep in mind that largely what's going on here is not a race issue, but a class issue. And this has been actually also has been discussed quite a bit in literature, too.
Yeah, we're not making this up,
Buzzkillers. We're not making this up. I'm sure other Buzzkillers are aware, for example, that, first of all, university education was much more of an elite thing in the 1960s. It was not a mass phenomenon like it is today. And you could get out of combat in Vietnam with what was called a deferment.
Right.
If you were a college student enrolled in good standing, you could get out of Vietnam. Well,
that's a college deferment, not an injury deferment, not a medical deferment recently.
And you could get multiple ones of those. I think Dick Cheney, for example, famously had five college deferments. Yeah. You know, and there's not necessarily anything wrong with those, but that's something that was available to the upper class and not to the working class.
Sure.
So, I mean, I haven't seen the data by class, but I'm pretty sure that poor white people were also, or in working class white people, were also overrepresented not only in the military but in combat units.
Absolutely.
Because keep in mind also that if you have a college education and you go into the military, you're probably not going to be put in a combat unit.
No.
You're going to be put into intelligence, for example, or some other sort of branch that often requires more education. And so, or they'll send you and they'll make you an officer, often is what happened if you had college education. That was certainly true in World War II.
So does the military notice that they're initially taking more?
Yes, they do. They do notice that African Americans are suffering disproportionate casualties, and they take corrective action. Various policies, which we don't need to go into, but they do take some steps because they recognize that it's an issue. And by the end of the war, African Americans constitute 12.5% of combat deaths, which is roughly equal to the black percentage of draft eligible men.
Oh, okay.
And very roughly equal to the black percentage to the percentage of men in the military who are black, which was about 10%. So in other words, the overall percentage of the total military that is black is 10%, and the percentage of combat deaths is 12.5%. So they're not precisely the same. The one is a little bit higher, but it's not way out of whack. It's roughly proportional.
And if the military and the government not only notices these things, but takes measures to correct it, means that there isn't some sort of overarching policy to all the way to 1974 clean out the ghettos.
Correct. You know, and it doesn't mean there weren't other racial aspects to the war in
Vietnam. Yeah, absolutely.
And
it doesn't
mean that the Vietnam War wasn't bad for the black community, which it was,
as
Martin Luther King pointed out. But this one claim doesn't seem to hold water.
Okay, this is a good place, Buzzkillers, to take a break for station identification. We'll be back in a minute.
Hello, this is Antonia Buzzkill. Please support my daddy by going to ProfessorBuzzkill.com and clicking on the Patreon button. While you're there, subscribe to his email list and shop the Buzzkill bookshelf. Follow him on Facebook, on Twitter at BuzzkillProf, and on Instagram at ProfessorBuzzkill. Professor Buzzkill is part of Entertainment One's podcast network and is available on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, and all major podcast apps. Please leave a review while you're there. Thanks for listening.
Okay, we're back, Buzzkillers. One thing that I noticed, Professor, is that there are so many of these myths, and they come from so many different areas and angles. There is no overarching sort of myth-making machine on the left or the right or the middle or any, you know.
Right. Yeah, a lot of these, if you look at some of the myths I've already gone through, a lot of them have no ideological content one way or another. I would argue that they cannot legitimately be interpreted as either a left-wing or right-wing myth or a left-wing or right-wing debunking of a myth.
Yeah, so we don't know about a hippie myth machine out there.
Yeah, I mean, and to the extent that is Ken Burns' goal, I share that goal, which is I think going forward, I think we'd all be better served if we sort of depoliticize this as much as we can.
Yeah.
Turn down the heat a little bit and have rational discussion and not immediately jump to conclusions or automatically sort things into a left wing or a right wing box and be sort of super sensitive to someone's political views as opposed to the merits of the point they're making.
And that brings us right to this myth we're going to discuss next, which is this, you know, how solid and monolithic were the different sides of the debate.
Right. And I think, I don't know for a fact how widespread this myth is. It's just my sense when you hear lay people talk about Vietnam.
Yeah.
Especially people who are, once again, ideologically motivated one way or another. They tend to often sort of deal in stereotypes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially when it comes to the domestic debate. And I think, for example, among people who opposed the Vietnam War, it was very, very easy and is easy to sort of dismiss pro-war people as sort of rednecks. Dismiss pro-war people as rednecks or as sort of old, stodgy conservatives who don't know what's going on in the world and sort of outdated thinking. And flip side, I think you can find a lot of people on the right who, if you ask them about the anti-war movement in Vietnam, they'll immediately say, well, hippies.
Yeah, yeah.
Sort of people who... People completely disaffected, drug users, grow their hair long, hate America, and so of course they're against the Vietnam War.
Right.
Those are both myths. Mm-hmm. If my basic thesis here is that both sides, both the pro-war, and you had a very vigorous debate going on in the country.
Yeah.
In print, in public, around dinner tables, sort of society-wide, that both sides in that debate, in that discussion, or all sides, I should say, in that debate discussion were incredibly diverse.
Yeah.
By the way, on both sides, the extremes, as usual, tend to get all the attention.
Yeah,
that's
right.
That's part of the purpose of being an extremist. Yeah, that's right. You know, and for example, the Weather Underground, in other words, the truly radical revolutionaries on the left who want to destroy American society and are willing to kill people and rob banks to do it, they do not, and by the way, you can find some really bad books that let those people stand for the entire anti-war movement,
which is
ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, that's not history, that's propaganda.
Yeah.
You know, they get a lot of attention because they're really sensational and sort of they're basically whack jobs.
But the numbers of them and the effect is minimal.
They're super tiny and their effect is minimal. Yeah. And for every weatherman, you've probably got 100 people in the anti-war movement who are not weathermen.
Sure.
So
or probably more than that. Yeah.
So it does a disservice to both sides when we harp on these extremists who do exist on both sides.
Uh-huh.
But it's a disservice to all the other people. Look at the anti-war movement.
Yeah.
First of all, you see it in the Ken Burns series. Some of the footage he uses is amazing, especially early on, like in 65. You look at, they have footage of the anti-war protests.
Yeah.
All the kids are incredibly clean cut.
Yes, that's
short
right.
Short hair,
that's right.
Right?
White shirt.
White shirts, windbreakers, whatever, loafers.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, that's going to change to some extent, although the change you're going to see later on is partly the broader social change, right, where people start to grow their sideburns, even like, quote unquote, respectable people do.
That's right, yeah.
And so you have... Lots of people across the spectrum who come to oppose the Vietnam War, like in the civil rights movement, for example.
Yeah, that's
Martin
right.
Luther
yeah.
King. A lot of people, we need to do a King episode, because King disappears between the March on Washington, the I Have a Dream speech, and his assassination. In the popular concert, there's a 5-year period where he disappears in the public knowledge.
Oh, yes.
One of the things he's doing, he's coming out strongly against the Vietnam War in 1967.
Oh, okay.
Partly because of the bad effect on the civil rights movement.
Sure.
And
sure.
By the way, he becomes reviled by Lyndon Johnson because he turns against the war.
Yeah.
And he's not the only one. A lot of the civil rights movement, they do make some claims about how African Americans are doing more than their share of the fighting, but they also make bigger arguments. Like, for example, all the money this is costing is undermining the Great Society programs and the things that are going to help lift black people out of poverty. Huge issue on the civil rights movement. A lot of church leaders and church members, even mainline Protestant and Catholic churches, come out against the war.
Yeah, that's
they're
right.
not hippies.
No.
In fact, socially, these are some really conservative people.
Yeah, yeah.
But they come out against the war. There are business leaders who come out against the war, especially by the time you get to early 68 in the time of Tet, because the war is wreaking havoc on the American financial system.
Oh, okay.
And the country is starting to flirt with bankruptcy, and they worry about the effect on the economy. These are not wild-eyed radicals.
No. These are the Weather Underground.
These are like shareholders. These are people on Wall Street. Some of whom, a lot of them remain pro-war, but a lot of them become anti-war.
So, but also, I mean, that's absolutely amazing because, of course, that's not only not the way we think about it, but we tend to forget that you know, most people have brains and they can fall into not only the categories of what they belong, of what, you know, their background, but they can start thinking about things.
And that they're even the biggest protest, which is, I don't know, 100,000, 200,000 people, those are big protests. That's still a tiny minority. You've got a lot of people, but look at the polling data. A lot of people oppose the war in Vietnam, even from an early date, and never go and protest.
Oh, sure, of course. Yeah.
But they're still anti-war, and they're part of the reason why it's been difficult to sustain the war. And finally, there's one last group, which I can't forget, probably the most important of all, Vietnam veterans.
Oh, right. Yes, of course.
It's a really uncomfortable fact for some on the right that a lot of people who opposed the Vietnam War were people who served in Vietnam.
Yeah.
Thousands of them. There was an entire organization called Vietnam Veterans Against the War. Yep. There were lots of people in 1971, veterans, who had been decorated.
Yeah.
Famously, I think it's called Dewey Canyon 3. There was this big protest event. They went to the Capitol, and some of them, with tears in their eyes, threw their medals back. Turned their medals back in because they were so upset against the war. These are not hippies. Well, some of them may have become hippies, I guess you could say.
Right, sure.
But these are people who had served their country in Vietnam. So this is a really, really diverse movement. And by the way, maybe not quite as diverse, but still more diverse than you would think is the pro-war side. I hesitate to call it the pro-war movement.
Yeah, that's right. Right. Yeah.
But, you know, often the people who get the attention are, for example, the hard hats.
Yes.
Who in New York City famously once, I forgot what year it was, I think it was in 68, where there was an anti-war protest and these hard hats working on a construction site in Manhattan basically took time off from work to go out into the crowd and start beating on people.
Yeah.
That's a good story. They get the attention. But you had lots and lots of people from all walks of life who thought the Vietnam War was worth fighting and it was a righteous cause, including some young people, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't get any attention. You had this organization called Young Americans for Freedom on college campuses. It wasn't as big as SDS, didn't get all the attention, but they were pro-war.
Yeah.
You had a lot of people who you might think would be anti-war but are pro-war. They're not numerous, but you have some professors who are pro-war.
Right.
In other words, this country is too big and diverse, and this was too big an issue to have just sort of monolithic poles fighting over this issue. But there's just too many people involved.
But that also brings up the bigger category, the bigger sort of myth and misconception of the kind of categories of the war. It's about the Cold War. It's about this, and those are simplistic answers,
right? And in episode one, I tried to give you some sense of how complicated it was.
Yeah, our first
Vietnam episode. I tried to give you a sense of how complicated it was.
We don't want anyone to confuse us with Ken Burns.
Oh, there's no danger of that. but I was just scratching on the surface because of the time issue, but. How you frame the war is important, and this is something where other people have, rightly in my view, criticized the Ken Burns series, which even though the Ken Burns series, to its great credit, does a lot of great things, and it's a masterful production, and people really should watch it. It's terrific. You can learn a lot. I learned a lot. They do a great job of incorporating Vietnamese voices, but still the basic frame of the show is a Cold War frame.
Yeah.
This is ultimately about the struggle between the United States and its enemies in the Cold War. And that the struggle inside even within Vietnam is essentially a struggle about communism and anti-communism.
Mm-hmm.
That obviously is not false. That's a big part of the story.
Well, yeah, but
it's not the only part of the story.
Right, right.
For example, one of the many problems that you had in South Vietnamese society that made it so that regime was not tenable and that the Viet Cong had so much success rounding up popular support is that in a way it was still a colonial economy. And in some ways, the French weren't there anymore, the South Vietnamese economy in the early 1960s was still in a lot of ways like the economy you saw during the French colonial period. For example, highly concentrated ownership of land.
Yeah.
And unsuccessful land reform. By the way, in the communist north, for all its problems, you did have some land reform and you did have some distribution of land to peasants much more successfully than you had in the south. In the south, you would still have things like, an anecdote I always liked, in a traditional Vietnamese society, or at least under the French, if you were an upper-class Vietnamese woman, you grew the fingernails on one of your hands super, super long.
Yeah.
Because it was a way of signifying that you didn't have to do any manual labor.
That's right, yeah.
Under the Diem regime in the early 1960s, you had South Vietnamese government officials who were essentially development officers, right?
Yeah.
Going out in the rural areas trying to sort of make people's lives better. And some of the women would keep the fingernails long on one hand.
Oh.
Now, it's just one little anecdote, but it's basically, I'm supposed to help you, but let's not forget who's who. Right? Let's not forget that you're basically a good-for-nothing peasant.
Working with your hands.
And I'm an important person. In other words, this is like noblesse oblige. I'm deigning to get my feet dirty to help you poor peasants out.
Again, a French term.
Right. That's not the kind of thing that your typical Viet Cong recruiter is doing. And that's because in the South, you've got these lingering, this sort of class conflict, which really has nothing to do with the Cold War.
Right, right. Again, this idea of a civil war and things going on domestically in Vietnam that we don't get enough of, we don't hear enough about.
Yeah. And so if you're a Vietnam recruiter, you can say, your landlord who's oppressing you and, like, for example, responsible for you not getting a big enough share or you're not eating right or you paying too much in taxes.
Yeah.
These people they're Vietnamese, but they're essentially puppets.
Yeah,
and they're essentially the French, and they'd all get lumped together, fairly or not. They'd all get lumped together, and that message really resonated,
sure,
among a lot of people in the South. And then, am I going to become a guerrilla? No, but I might hide some rice for guerrillas.
Yeah,
or I might refuse to give the Arvin and the American advisors information about the Viet Cong that I have and refuse to share.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, there are lots of gradations.
Kind of passive resistance.
Right.
Yeah.
There's lots of gradations of sort of help or non-cooperation with the Americans that you can do, and it's not just about the Cold War. A lot of, let's face it, like around the world, a lot of peasants are apolitical.
Yeah.
They don't know what communism is.
They're too busy being poor.
Yeah. Or they're too busy being illiterate and couldn't understand, or even if they wanted to, they could never be sort of immersed in these broader issues. They don't read the International Herald Tribune.
No.
They don't know about the Cold War. But they do know about their harvest.
Yeah.
And they know whether they're being oppressed.
Yeah.
And they know if maybe their kids are going to get an education. They know those sorts of things. And they're hearing different things from the two sides. And one side has a lot more credibility than the other.
Yeah, to them, yeah.
Yeah. And that's about some more sort of inherent structural issues that have nothing to do with the Cold War.
But again, we keep returning. We turn to the idea that there's a civil war in Vietnam as well, and that Americans largely don't know about that. There are a lot of other things Americans don't know about, but still these myths have been invented.
Sure.
And have a
lasting effect.
Oh, and a very strongly held.
Ripple effects, right.
These beliefs are very strongly
held. One of these, I will just come out and flat out say, there's a right-wing myth because that's what it is. And that's the myth of POW, American POWs being held in Vietnam after 1973.
Right.
And by the way, this is not just me. The official, you can look it up. Don't take my word for it. Look it up. The official stance of the United States government is that no Americans are being held in Vietnam right now. And this was their stance in the 1980s when this was a much bigger issue.
Right.
And that's the good news. It's not as big of an issue anymore.
Yeah,
but
sure.
People should know. Let me ask people this, or I'll ask you this. What's the one private organization that has its flag flown over all U.S. post offices along with the American flag?
The POWMIA one.
POWMIA. It has a unique status as a private organization. One organization it's ordered. You are ordered as a post office to fly this flag. It's flown elsewhere too, like in the Capitol. It's a private organization, POWMIA. I'm sure people have seen it. You see the flag with the sticker everywhere. And by the way, it might be hard to depict, but the person depicted on that flag is not a person who's missing. It's a person who's being held as a POW.
Their head
is stooped forward, and behind them you can see a guard tower.
Yeah, it's obviously.
And that's because
it's the black flag.
Yeah, and like I said, it's less of an issue now. And not to my knowledge, you have people claiming that still in 2017 our American POWs have been held in Vietnam.
Yeah.
But long after 1973.
Oh, yeah.
Well into the 80s and into the 90s, certainly through the 80s, you had a lot of people claiming that Americans, that some of the missing...
Yeah.
And there were, at first, there were 2,600 official U.S. missing in action from Vietnam War, which, by the way, compared to our other wars, is an extremely low number.
Oh, okay.
Doesn't mean that's not an important issue.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
But my point is, by the time we get to Vietnam, we do a darn good job of accounting for people.
Right.
If you look at numbers served and number officially missing, now it's down to about 1,600. We've accounted for another 1,000, basically. Right. But the claim was a lot of these people were being held prisoner by the Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
There was the organization was called the National League of Families.
Right.
And
right.
This is actually founded before 1973 and in some ways is a totally legit organization.
Yeah,
they were
sure,
because
yeah.
they were the families of those who were being held, people like Don McCain, who were being held and wanted to make sure that they were released as soon as possible.
Yeah.
And totally
legit. We're talking about 73 where it's happened.
The war's still going on. Well, no, this is actually before 73.
Oh, sorry. Yeah.
Before 73 when this organization is founded and wants to put the focus fairly enough on POWs. They become involved with the Nixon administration, which has its own axe to grind for various political reasons we won't get into. The Nixon administration also wants to hype the POW issue.
Yeah.
And so this sort of snowballs. And in 1973, like I said, you do have the Paris Accords. The POWs being held by the North Vietnamese are released, but we still have 2,600 people missing.
Right.
And some people immediately then claim, oh, they're still being held. Now, in some ways, this very claim is illogical, certainly by the time you get to the 80s. Because my question would be, what could Hanoi possibly gain by continuing to hold U.S. POWs and lie about it?
And it's expensive, to say the very least.
Yes, especially because by the time we get to the 80s, the Vietnamese are much more interested in normalizing relations with the United States than the United States is.
And
by that point, the allegation of POWs still being held becomes an issue and becomes an obstacle to an improvement in those relations. So it's kind of absurd on its face.
Yeah.
Another question would be, what do they get out of it?
Yeah.
Are American fighter pilots have some sort of skill that they can put to use as slave laborers that the North Vietnamese are getting out of this? I mean, it just doesn't make any sense.
Right.
More importantly, there was never any proof found.
Right. That's the most important.
There were all sorts of people who tried to find proof. There were even some private missions sent into Southeast Asia looking for POWs, and they never found anything. Yeah. So very quickly, the official stance of the government was, oh, by the way, there's no evidence of any people being held.
Yeah. Now,
didn't matter, though.
Yeah. Well, we forget that missing in action could mean lots of different things, and they're very hard to find genuinely missing in action.
And by the way, my understanding is under the rules that there were cases where they knew someone was dead but didn't recover the body.
Oh, okay.
And under the rules, that person must be officially listed as missing. For example, you witness a jet aircraft crash into the ocean.
Oh, sure.
Plane sinks. You recover no body. But you saw the plane go in. You never recovered anybody alive. You know pretty certainly that person's dead.
Yeah, that's right.
But they're listed as missing.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, or for example, someone suffers a direct hit by an artillery shell and there's literally no body, which did happen on occasion. You have no body, but you list that person's missing. Now, the problem is then this quickly, the POW-MIA organization, and notice those two, you always said those words together.
Yeah.
And that's deliberate.
Yeah.
It's so that when you hear the word MIA, you think POW. You think that they're one and the same, when of course they weren't.
No, not at all.
But that's a deliberate conflation to sort of lead to this, and it becomes a campaign, and it becomes a really powerful theme in our subculture and in our culture. They become a powerful lobby and so untouchable and impossible to criticize or say anything bad about that we end up flying their flag everywhere. And by the way, let's be very clear here. The effort to find out what happened to MIAs is important.
Oh, sure.
Totally legitimate to this day, by the way. We have teams in Vietnam right now that are working with Vietnamese trying to find remains and have had great success in getting that number from 2,600 down to 1,600, by the way.
And 1,600 out of 500,000. Again, not all half a million is not combat veterans.
But many more than that actually served.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, that's right. Millions of people served in Vietnam. In any case, this really took on a life of its own in popular culture because you had a whole series of movies. And I'm sure Buzzkillers may have seen more than one of them. Movies like, and this is just a partial list, movies like Uncommon Valor or Missing in Action. In fact, there were multiple Missing in Action. These are the Chuck Norris Braddock movies.
Yeah.
There was, most famous of all, Rambo, First Blood Part 2.
Yeah.
The first Rambo movie wasn't nearly as big a hit.
He just
plays the sort of disaffected returning Green Beret who's mistreated by local law enforcement, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
In the second one, he goes back into Vietnam to rescue POWs who are being held. And like with a lot of movies, I'm sure a lot of people watched the movie and it essentially concluded, wow, they're still holding our POWs. That's awful.
Yeah, that's right.
It's also, I mean, you know, and it depicts a lot of cruelty. Like, for example, in the movie, John Rambo is part of this really evil government program that forces people to take steroids so they end up looking like really short professional wrestlers.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Even though they've been in a prisoner of war camp.
More seriously, this is the movie where Sylvester Stallone says, "Do we get to win this time?"
Yeah, which is of course the
giving voice to the whole stab in the back, or we were forced to fight with one hand tied behind our back, etc. But these are very popular movies and become part of this sort of cultural phenomenon in which, wow, they're holding our POWs. That's really evil. Of course, we can't normalize relations with the Vietnamese. And this is there's an axe to grind behind a lot of this. A lot of people are trying to demonize Vietnam after the war to prevent the relationship from improving. culturally, a lot of what the movies are about is us sort of symbolically winning the Vietnam War after the fact.
Right.
Right. Like, how can we feel good about Vietnam? Well, we go in and rescue some of our brave pilots who have been tortured by the evil Vietnamese. That's how you win the war after having lost it. And that's one of the reasons those movies are so popular.
Yeah.
And remember, it was First Blood Part 2 is 1985, I think. It's just 10 years after the end of the war, 12 years after our war. It's still pretty fresh.
Yeah.
The Vietnam Memorial is only 3 years old at that point.
Yeah.
You know, it's a lot of this is lost. It's importance and as an issue, but it's a pretty important myth.
There's a similar sort of idea with this very similar approach, and that is that even though John Rambo has colleagues who are left in Vietnam and we didn't win, returning U.S. soldiers were treated almost as if they were war criminals.
Right. And this is not a myth. I'm not going to call it a myth.
No.
This is a story that I think is in the heads of a lot of people a simple morality play, which needs to be complicated.
Yeah.
I think that's how I'll put it. Because it is true, certainly if you believe a lot of the anecdotes, it's true that a lot of Vietnam veterans were mistreated when they returned.
Right.
It's true that a lot of people in the anti-war movement were, shall we say, not careful with the way they spread blame around.
Right.
I think that's safe to say. But the idea that massive numbers of troops were physically mistreated, for example, most famously having been spat upon when they returned.
Right. Usually by hippies, so the story goes.
Usually by hippies, so the story goes. Obviously, I can't say that never happened.
Yeah.
I can't say that didn't happen a lot. What I can say is there's reason to doubt it happened as much as some people think it did.
And there's reason to doubt that because there's practically no evidence.
There's practically no evidence. Now, as we were talking earlier, once again, the absence of evidence is not... Sorry, the absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Where it's very difficult to prove a negative.
Yeah.
But, for example, some of the people have looked at this. If you had confrontations, like, for example, at an airport or at a bus depot where a person in uniform is spat upon, you would expect those sorts of confrontations to be noticed and recorded at the time.
Right.
For example, you might expect a fistfight to break out.
Sure.
You might expect maybe the police to be called in and maybe there's an arrest record. You might expect a local journalist to write about it. You might expect someone to maybe have captured it on camera.
Mm-hmm.
Or you might have expected someone to write about it at the time, maybe a letter to an editor, et cetera.
Or even a personal letter at home.
This evidence may be out there. But the people who have looked into this haven't found it yet.
And they've been looking into it for 20-some-odd years.
Been looking at it for a while. There's also, for example, reason to believe that a lot of the stories of GIs being spat upon, a lot of those stories you don't start to see until long after the war is over.
That's right, yeah.
Like until maybe around 1980.
Yeah.
Once again, that doesn't mean it didn't happen.
No.
It means you have to sort of be skeptical about this and ask questions about it. Like, if it is true that these stories only pop up long after the war is over, you should ask why.
Right.
Why is that? Why aren't people upset right away about this happening? So,
and also the stories that are told are so very, very, very similar. This is one of the sort of, 10 warning signs of a myth. It's always three hippies. There's always a girl involved.
Right.
And it's always at an airport or a bus depot. And it's always a lone Vietnam vet getting off a plane coming out, when in reality, lots of Vietnam vets came back in groups,
as a group.
Especially when transported that way.
When, by the way, if there were someone there to spit on you, there might be some serious repercussions.
Oh, yeah.
For example, right? In other words, it's easy to target a single soldier, but not a whole bunch of them who have just gone off the bus.
And the numbers of soldiers who came back singly was very, very few.
Right. Now, I would also say that it's reasonable to conclude that at least part of this storytelling, part of it may be perfectly genuine, perfectly innocent, perfectly neutral. Some of it is also clearly intended to discredit the anti-war movement.
Absolutely.
And often the people who complain about the alleged mistreatment of returning GIs, are the same people who talk about us having fought with only one hand with one hand tied behind our back.
Right.
We talk about stab in the back. We talk about treason. We could have won if only if it weren't for liberals and leftists and traitors. They often tend to be the same people.
Yeah.
And so, in other words, they have an interest in making the anti-war movement look like it's this extreme, hateful cardboard cutout that exists right. in a lot of people's heads.
Right. And as we and you've talked about earlier in this show and a little bit in the previous show, the anti-war movement is very, very diverse. So why is it only the hippie girl among the three hippies in the who right. does this spitting?
That's right.
But that brings up what you just said. There brings up something that we really should do, and that is we should look at these things more than once and be careful when accepting just the accepting the Rambo story. As completely true right. on its face.
And we should also know that not all historical sources are the same.
No.
And that you shouldn't necessarily accept as gospel what somebody says who was quote-unquote there at the time.
Right.
Oral history is an important source of information for historians.
Yeah.
You also have to be careful with it. And I'll give you a very good example from the Ken Burns series. Ken Burns deliberately makes the decision in he talks to historians in his other shows. There are no historians on camera.
Yeah.
The work of historians deeply informs the script and yeah. the narration,
yeah.
and they've done their homework.
Yeah.
But they only talk to people who were, quote-unquote, there, people who were participants.
Yeah.
Here's the problem. These were people, and I'm not original with me. Someone else pointed this out, but I think it's a very valid point. If you interview someone in 2015 about the Vietnam War, there's been 40 intervening years.
Yeah.
During which that person who was in Vietnam or a nurse in Vietnam or a reporter in Vietnam, whatever, 40 years during which they have not been living in a bubble.
Right.
They have been, like the rest of us, absorbing all sorts of information from various sources, some of it good, some of it bad. They've watched movies. They've read books about Vietnam. And so they're not, quote unquote, just giving you, quote unquote, what they experienced
uh-huh.
at the time. Mm-hmm. That's one of the reasons why if you want to do an oral history, you do it like right immediately after the event.
Yeah, that's right.
That would be a better interview, all else being equal, than yeah. one taken 40 years later. And I've seen it in the episodes I've watched several times. You have someone making a general point about the nature of the Vietnam War, or the nature of American decision-making, or whatever, that are points made by historians over yeah. and over and over again. And it's yeah. pretty clear that the person got that from reading history, not from what they witnessed themselves.
And they got the history after the fact, long after
right.
the fact.
Yeah. And so, in other words, their memories, which are never perfect to begin with,
sure.
have been further no muddied, one's have been no further one's sort of blurred by the intervening years.
Yeah.
And so on the one hand, yeah, I don't want to rely on historians, but you are kind of relying on historians.
And, yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
you're being less than honest about it in a way. That's one of
the Ken Burns
beefs
I have. Yeah.
Right. But, you know, and that's true of memory as opposed to history generally.
Yeah.
Someone who says, oh, I experienced this during the Vietnam period and it was awful. Did they really experience it?
Yeah.
Probably yes.
Yeah.
Maybe not.
Yeah.
Maybe not in exactly the way it did happen.
That's right.
Right.
Or the time that they think it happened. And
right.
On,
I mean,
on.
Look at how unreliable eyewitness testimony is in criminal cases in court.
Oh, absolutely.
Right. Yeah. If you're a prosecutor, you really don't want to have to rely on eyewitnesses.
No.
Okay. Oral history is kind of a related item.
And usually with a longer gap in between the event and the
right.
testimony.
And so then when you layer on that, what people have read and their political views and what constitutes a good story and something you feel to be true, even though you didn't yeah. actually experience it yourself, that can tweak your memory and then you can make it yours.
Yeah.
And you can convince yourself of something that happened, even if it didn't, or even if it didn't happen in the way it really did. So that's why these sorts of interviews, while they can be fascinating and are valuable, they have to be treated very, very carefully.
So what should we take, Professor, from the Ken Burns series, from the things we've talked about in this episode and the other Vietnam War episode?
Well, you know, he's honest about this. His whole approach with this series in particular is to try and use this as a way to help the country heal.
Yeah.
I wouldn't necessarily even agree that that's the way you should do a documentary.
Yeah.
But, and you know, for example, I think it leads him to say things like, well, they were all well-intentioned.
Yeah, right.
I think,
yeah, sure.
And I think it leads you to file off some of the edges. And for example, I read an article about this. For hours, they debated what to call the outcome, and they refused to call it a defeat. They called it a failure. And they agonized over those sorts of things.
Yeah,
and I think it's partly because they want to avoid controversy, and they want this to be an exercise of us bringing us together.
Yeah, sure.
I might not agree with that's the way you should do a documentary.
Yeah.
I think it's a very laudable goal in general. You know, and for example, if you ask me, like, why should you study the Vietnam War? Well, because I think we can learn some lessons. We can also learn a lot about ourselves.
Yeah.
If we're honest in the process, if we question myths rather than reinforce them.
Yeah.
Right? If we try to avoid confirmation bias, right? Read something you disagree with.
Yeah.
Read about some people you don't like.
Yeah.
Right? Watch the Ken Burns series. Learn a lot. Go read some more. That's all good. Right? I would never say, oh, that's bad if you read too many books about Vietnam.
Yeah.
You'll never see me say
no,
that.
No.
And there's a lot to read, and you could spend a lot of time doing it, but there's a lot of great stuff out there that you can use to build your understanding, and I think long-term, I think that can help bring us together.
Well, that's a great way to segue into telling the Buzzkills. We've got lots of good stuff about this and about all the myths we examine on the show on the Buzzkill bookshelf. So just quickly, thank you, Professor. Thank you for coming once again.
My pleasure.
To talk to us. And Buzzkillers out there, we'll talk to you next week.